for the first time in weeks, I was having a down day and I'd just gone out for a run. And then suddenly, you know, it was interrupted with a phone call saying Oscar Pistorius has killed his girlfriend. There was just so much confusion at that time as to what had happened. I spoke to his agent to see if he knew anything much about it, and he was completely playing it straight and blank, and no, I don't know much about this, or, you know, so there was that added to even more confusion. Suddenly there was these pictures of a baseball bat, a picture of a gun. There were pictures of this bloodied little toilet area where Riva Steenkamp was. And for a lot of people, their decision from that moment onwards was made that Oscar Pistorius was guilty of murder.
Track and field star Oscar Pistorius inspired the world as the first double leg amputee to compete at the Olympic Games. Then he shocked the world with tragedy when his girlfriend was shot dead and he was convicted. A new series from ESPN Films tells the story of the South African athlete. And today, we hear what it was like to cover the man they called Blade Runner in his rise and fall. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, October 1st. This is ESPN Daily. Hey, Dan Williams. Thank you for joining me on ESPN Daily.
Hey, Pablo. Good to be here.
Dan Williams was an ESPN correspondent in South Africa from 2007 to 2013. He's featured in The Life and Trials of Oscar Pistorius, a documentary series out now on ESPN+. If you close your eyes and you hear the name Oscar Pistorius, what's the image that comes to mind if you could describe him to us?
To begin with, I suppose the image in 2012 would be a lot different to the image that I now have. It's very difficult now to see beyond the image of him sobbing in a courtroom. That's really the image that I now have of Oscar Pistorius. But prior to February 14th, 2013, my image of Oscar Pistorius would be, in a way, this perfect specimen of a human. He had these kind of film star type looks. He had this kind of perfect body. And then he had these futuristic blades that made him look superhuman. He was born with the absence of his fibula, so the bottom part of his legs, essentially. And before he was even celebrated his first birthday, a decision was taken for him to have the bottom part of his legs amputated. I know that there was at the time a lot of debate as to how best to do that. And there were some doctors that wanted to amputate quite high up on the leg, so above the knee at least. And one expert said no. The upper part of his leg shin is perfectly fine. So let's do the amputation where we need to. And so he has still a significant part of his stump still there on both legs, just below the knee. That decision really allowed Oscar Pistorius to become the athlete that he then became.
How did Oscar Pistorius get his start in track and field?
Oscar Pistorius goes to what is quite a prestigious boys' school. And in South Africa, the big sport is rugby. The schoolmaster tells this story of, and it's a crazy situation if you can imagine, he gets the ball, he's on the wing, he's quite fast, and he's not wearing these supersonic blades, he's wearing just normal prosthetics. And the person comes in to tackle him. And in rugby, you tackle around the legs. And so the person tackled him, grabbed hold of a leg, and Oscar Pistorius hops away. The guy's left holding a leg. And it's one of those legendary stories. while playing rugby, Oscar Pistorius then picked up an injury. And while he's undertaking that physio, he comes into contact with a coach. And that coach teaches track and field. And he persuades Oscar Pistorius to come and try out and to come for a run. And that is where Oscar Pistorius, the Paralympian, the Olympian, really came into being.
So Oscar became very good very quickly. At age 17, he won gold at the 2004 Paralympic Games, which is kind of the companion event to the Olympics for athletes with a wide range of different abilities and disabilities. But Oscar also wanted to cross over and compete in the overall Olympics, and he set his sights on the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing. Dan, you began working for ESPN in 2007, a year before. What was going on with Oscar at that time?
In 2007, when I arrived in South Africa, it didn't take very long before Oscar Pistorius was starting to make some headlines.
The South African Paralympic champion has broken all the flat sprint records in his class and now wants to compete in the able-bodied Olympics. But the organization which runs international athletics, the IAAF, claims that the high-tech fiberglass blades on which he runs give him an unfair advantage.
There was some kind of judgment that was handed down where he couldn't now run. And that was the first time I met him. It was in Pretoria, the capital. And we ended up doing a 20-minute sit-down interview with him. And this was the moment where he felt that his career had been completely closed off.
It must be very hard to have all of this going on when all you really want to do is to run.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, every athlete to perform to their optimum peak is just to train and be able to sleep and diet properly, you know, when you need to. And obviously this has been a pretty large distraction and not the best way to start.
He was no longer able to compete against able-bodied athletes, which meant, I suppose, as well, that his thoughts of his dream were closed off from him. But then very soon after that, we then had the news that that had been overturned and he was able to then suddenly compete.
The Court of Arbitration for Sport has decided that the IAAF did not establish that the prosthesis used by Oscar Pistorius gave him an advantage over other athletes.
And so you had this fighting element of Oscar Pistorius, and he fought against what he felt was, and what a lot of people felt was just wrong. And he managed to win through that. Even though he missed out on running in the 2008 Olympic Games, you know, he still had the origins of what was going to be a successful story.
What would you say was the height of Oscar's athletic achievements?
The very height of his athletic achievement really was clearly just stepping onto the track in London at the 2012 Olympic Games.
South Africa's Oscar Pistorius has made history by becoming the first man to run in the Paralympics and Olympics. The man dubbed the Blade Runner came second in his 400 metres heat, crossing the line in 45.44 seconds and comfortably securing his place in the semi-finals.
Being in London, you could really see that, you know, there were a few stars in London. You know, Usain Bolt, there was Mo Farah and others. But Oscar Pistorius absolutely deserved his place to be mentioned amongst those. It didn't really matter whether he won a medal or even made it through the first heat. His battle was to be able to compete against able-bodied athletes. And the story was just incredible. In 2012, he stepped onto that track and challenged this notion of disability.
A lot of people are scared to talk about disability or feel that the stigma, it's nothing to be ashamed of, it's nothing to frown upon, and we can talk about it. It's not a topic that needs to be kept quiet.
There was so much about that Oscar Pistorius story that just resonated, I think, with the world, that we all, in a way, wanted to be a part of that story. We love fighters. We love people who challenge the norms of society to deserve their place in this world. It wasn't so much what he could achieve on the tracks, although that was part of it. It was what he stood for, what he was about, and what he meant to so many people.
Dan, let's move to Valentine's Day 2013. That's the day that everything changes for Oscar Pistorius. It is 3 o'clock in the morning, and Oscar and his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, they're both asleep in Oscar's bedroom. What happens next?
He heard a noise in his bathroom. It was dark, and he shouted over to Riva Steenkamp, you know, take cover, go get help. He grabbed his gun and went to the bathroom. He says he shouted numerous times to the bathroom to Riva, who he said was, he thought, still back in the bedroom. He was on his stump, so he was, you know, obviously much shorter. And then he said he heard a noise, and then he fired into the door. Then when he went back to the bedroom to then put on his prosthetics, he realized that Riva Steenkamp wasn't in the bedroom anymore, and it started to dawn on him that, you know, maybe it was her. So then he got a baseball bat, hit down the door, according to him, and there was Riva Steenkamp bloodied, and I think by all accounts she died in his arms, and he carried her downstairs. Then he called various people, and he had neighbors come through, and the police arrived, and it was a chaotic scene. And he said the line then that he thought it was an intruder.
What happened next?
I think at that stage, some of the facts or some of the suggested facts, you know, had yet to emerge. I mean, was there an intruder there, perhaps? You know, what actually happened? But the media narrative changed locally in South Africa quite quickly, and then that was picked up by all the different international media news channels.
Oscar Pistorius has now spent his second night in jail after learning Friday that the prosecution plans to charge him with premeditated murder.
No, he's somebody that we used to love so much. We didn't think that he could do something like this, which is very tragic, and we as a country are kind of disappointed.
For most people, once that kind of narrative emerged, that was it. That was when Oscar Pistorius went from being, you know, this athlete and having that kind of maybe a concern as to, well, what happened and did he fear that there was an intruder, to suddenly, this is something else.
Coming up, what happened in court at the trial of Oscar Pistorius?
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
After being charged with murder, Oscar receives bail as he was not deemed a flight risk, and the trial begins on March 3rd, 2014. How significant of an event was this, Dan, in South Africa?
This was huge. There's not, over the course of time, being many court proceedings televised, and this one was. So this was broadcast on every channel. It was broadcast on every radio station. This was everywhere. The magazines, the newspapers, the international media had descended on South Africa like like nothing before. I mean, it was chaotic. And you had literally hundreds of journalists and cameras, photographers and videographers all standing around, able to converse with Oscar Pistorius in a way and film him. We were not allowed to film during the proceedings itself, but we were suddenly allowed to film when the judge left. So suddenly I'm presented with Oscar Pistorius in front of me, and I'm said, hey, how you doing? And, it was a silly question, but what else do you say? And because we knew each other. So it was a very difficult process to suddenly be challenged with the narrative of Oscar Pistorius.
Could you put into context for the American audience the recent history of South Africa and why Oscar Pistorius's initial reaction, according to his version of events, was to fear for his own life?
Crime in South Africa, violent crime and home invasions, it is an issue. There are daily stories of farmers and those in the townships as well and all over of people being broken into and suffering some horrific circumstances. That is a very common story, a common fear in South Africa still today. And so against that backdrop, you have this narrative of flight versus fight. And that does play a part in this story, certainly in terms of the defense story and Oscar's defense as to why he did what he did.
Walking down that passage, your intention is to go towards the danger.
That's correct, my lady.
You're vulnerable, but you go towards the danger.
That's correct, my lady.
Why would you do that?
Because if I'd stayed where I was, my lady, Reva and I would be in danger.
But the fact of this matter is, if you stayed in that room, Reva would have been alive.
Inside the courtroom at the trial, text message exchanges between Oscar and Reva are submitted as evidence. What do they show?
The prosecution brought up a number of text messages that seemed to suggest that that Oscar Pistorius had some falling outs with Reva Steenkamp and other people as well.
Explosive text messages are emerging in the murder trial of the Olympic double amputee known as the Blade Runner.
In one message sent to Pistorius just weeks before her death, Steenkamp said she feared him. "I'm scared of you sometimes," she said, "and how you snap at me."
It started to kind of build this narrative that actually Oscar Pistorius wasn't that kind to Reva Steenkamp. The defense managed to, I think, show that a lot of those text messages perhaps were just out of context. They did paint Oscar Pistorius in a different light, but they didn't necessarily prove that here was this terrible guy. But in the eyes of the public, I would say that they were very damning for Oscar Pistorius.
As his defense goes, one of the craziest aspects of this trial is that the accused took the stand. Why did Oscar Pistorius testify in this case?
It seemed from most of the legal experts that I was speaking to that in order for Oscar to really prove his innocence, that this was something that he just had to do. We saw somebody on the stand, what looked like somebody breaking down utterly.
That's it. Have a look there, mister. I know you don't want to because you don't want to take responsibility, but it's time that you look at it.
My lady, I've taken responsibility, but I will not look at a picture where I'm tormented by what I saw and felt that night. As I picked Reva up, my fingers touched her head. I remember. I don't have to look at a picture. I was there.
And yet you still even then had half the population of South Africa and I guess anyone else interested in the story around the world making a judgment that he's putting on the tears. Oscar Pistorius was putting that all on. It was all an act. To those others that felt heartfelt sorrow for this person who potentially had shot the love of his life. And it just depends, kind of which line that you stand on, because that's really what we're talking about here. It was either this horrific accident and he shot the love of his life, or it was a hot-headed move of somebody who purposefully murdered his girlfriend. There was another moment as well when Oscar Pistorius took off his prosthetic legs and walked around to show just how vulnerable he was. And that, again, goes back to this story as an athlete, right, of being this superstar athlete with the looks of David Beckham and looks invincible on the track, you know, and he's 6 foot tall and, you know, with his blades on and everything else, to this now in a courtroom, a very short, broken man. And I think that moment just showed just how his life had changed.
How did the judge rule at the end of trial?
The judge, it took a significant amount of time, and it became quite clear that she was not going to pass down a murder in the first degree.
On count one, murder read with section 51(1) of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, the accused is found not guilty and is discharged. Instead, he is found guilty of culpable homicide.
So in a way, Oscar Pistorius initially was cleared, really, of significant wrongdoing, and essentially was, having completed, you know, just a few years in prison, would be then allowed to leave. And that caused a huge uproar, especially in South Africa, because there was a significant number of people that felt very strongly and had predicted that this was going to be a strong judgment and that he would serve most of his life in prison. And yet within, I think, 6 months of that initial judgment, he was able to go home.
What happened next?
So then we go into a number of different appeals. And I remember speaking to a legal expert just before even the first trial began. And the thing that stuck in my mind from that interview was kind of fairly true. The South Africa legal system is flawed. Although there's one verdict, eventually justice is normally seen to be done, especially in these high-profile cases. So we then have this lengthy court process that the world's media was tuned into. And then suddenly you have these kind of appeals that, you know, these processes that take place thereafter, that really didn't get quite anywhere near the same kind of level, because it's not very TV friendly. It's just an announcement by the Supreme Court of Appeal. And then Oscar Pistorius essentially had his time suddenly increased.
As a matter of common sense, at the time the fatal shots were fired, the possibility of the death of the person behind the door was clearly an obvious result. The accused's conviction and sentence on count one are set aside and replaced with the following: guilty of murder, with the accused having had criminal intent in the form of dolus eventualis.
After two appeals, Oscar was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Where is he now?
Well, right now, he is still in prison. He is not, or has not been, convicted of intentionally murdering Reeva Steenkamp. That was not proven in a court of law. What the legal process decided is that he should serve a longer prison sentence for his actions that were considered reckless. It was decided that he should have known that his actions would cause the death of whoever was behind that door. So that is where he is today.
In terms of Reeva and the Steenkamp family, does her family believe that justice was served?
No. I mean, I think that since covering the deths of, you know, Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and others, I think the story is most people want to know the truth. Most people want to see the person who is responsible to take responsibility and to come and be honest. And I'm not suggesting that Oscar Pistorius isn't honest, but I am saying that as far as the Steenkamp family is concerned, for them, the story doesn't wash. That was certainly their message 7 years ago. I would have no reason to think that has changed in the meantime.
How do you think Oscar Pistorius is going to be remembered?
I think it's very difficult now to say how Oscar Pistorius is going to be remembered. Oscar Pistorius' story was going to be about his fight against the authorities, this fight to prove his abilities, and the success. You know, it's just an upward trajectory. But right now, he is this athlete who finds himself in a prison, destroyed. And of course, we can't forget Reeva Steenkamp in this narrative. And whatever Oscar Pistorius then now becomes, Reeva Steenkamp doesn't have that. And so that must always be remembered whenever we're talking about, you know, well, what next for Oscar Pistorius? And I've been asked the question before as to, can he come back? Can he, you know, will he compete? And I think absolutely there is that potential that he may decide to come back and compete once again. Whether the public want him, whether the public will accept him, you know, that's a different story.
Dane Williams, thank you so much for joining us and reexamining this story on ESPN Daily.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
You can stream the life and trials of Oscar Pistorius in four parts right now on ESPN Plus. Coming up, a look at the Jets-Broncos game tonight and everything that's at stake.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. It has been a long, long week of barely refereed televised conflict. And so America feels ready, maybe readier than ever, actually, for Thursday night football. Even if it's, well, Broncos Jets. But there is one person who probably isn't so excited for this evening. And he just happens to be the head coach of the New York Jets, Adam Gase. Sports media has been overflowing this week with reports that if Gase loses to the winless Broncos, he's gonna be fired by his 0-4 organization right after the game. This would realize the dreams of so many angry Jets fans who were promised just 20 games ago that Adam Gase would revolutionize their favorite team. Here's how the CEO of the Jets, Christopher Johnson, sold the hiring of Gase in January of last year.
You know, he is intelligent, forward-thinking, aggressive. He's to paraphrase Wayne Gretzky, he's coaching to where football is going.
But so far this season, Gase's football has mostly been going to the other team. Quarterback Sam Darnold, who got drafted third overall 2 years ago, has somehow regressed, throwing more interceptions than touchdowns. In fact, the entire defense and the entire offense are both circling the toilet right now, giving up 94 points while scoring just 37. It is worth noting that Gase's intelligent, forward-thinking, and aggressive offense was already the least efficient in the entire NFL last year. And yet, I should also tell you that all those reports about Gase's demise may be greatly exaggerated, and that all those angry Jets fan dreams may wind up just that. Dreams. Because exactly 2 weeks ago, that very same Jet CEO, Christopher Johnson, declared that he has, quote, full confidence in Adam. I think that he has a lot more in him as a head coach than some of our fans are giving him credit for. End quote. To which Gase, naturally, said this.
Like, I love working for Christopher Johnson. I mean, he has been the ultimate supporter, not only with...
Gase had more praise to offer his boss after that description, about how accessible Johnson is and how much he watches practice and how incredibly involved he is with his team. But all of it mostly amounts to an important, sobering reminder for not just Jets fans, but also the rest of us. Because maybe Johnson does have the stones to admit his mistakes and acknowledge all the polling data and fire Gase this weekend. And maybe he doesn't. But the real problem is not actually the head coach standing up there at the podium. The real nightmare is the person you cannot fire. It's the ultimate supporter who enabled him all along. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.